There we go. I think
That
now we
better?
see that. Yes, I believe we can see you. Good morning and welcome. And I'll ask the marshal to introduce the panel, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Johnson, Judge Hooten, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And welcome to the Virtual Court of Appeals once again here for March 9. We have three oral arguments. This is the first of three matters, and then we have non-oral matters to consider as well. And can both counsel see the clock fine in the with the blue background in the box on your computer?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, very good. Thank you. So you should be able to, everything else is pretty much normal in terms of the timing. Appellant will have 15 minutes, respondents counsel 15 minutes, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If at any time we lose you, especially audio from the audio standpoint, the marshal knows to stop the clock so you don't lose your time, and we try to resurrect connection. But we've had good luck of late, so hopefully that doesn't become an issue. We do ask that when you begin your comments that you identify your name for the record, and I'll make comment for any participants listening that no recording of these proceedings are allowed, subject to court rules, and the all proceedings will be available on the court's website within 24 hours if anyone wishes to again listen to them. And I'll note for the record then this first matter is Dana Rochelle Back, petitioner versus State of Minnesota. It's the State of Minnesota who's the appellant in this matter, A-20-1098. And counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the State of Minnesota. We are asking the court to reverse the district court's order for two reasons. First, this court's decision in Kingbird requires it. Petitioner Dana Back's conviction was not reversed on grounds consistent with innocence, but based on a legal technicality that arose only due to a clarification in the law of culpable negligence.
Well, can I stop you right there? Because I mean, didn't the Supreme Court decide that a negligent manslaughter case requires necessarily that there be a duty, and that this simply she did not have a duty to her boyfriend to do. You know, there was nothing the law requires that gives her a duty to protect her boyfriend. I guess that's how I would say it. I mean, why isn't this just a clarification at best of the law, or just an application of the law as it's always existed?
Your Honor, it's the state's position that it's a new clarification of the law. To look back to the prior cases on which the first Back, I believe it's Back 2, if I'm using my numbers correctly, decision decided, the law itself did not talk about a duty or a special relationship at the time. If you look, I believe it's cited in my reply brief, if you look at Schaub, in that decision, there was a tenant who was upset, was basically trying to commit suicide, and turned on gas tanks in his residence, and the landlord shut off one of them. The police escorted him out of there, and then inadvertently the landlord hit a switch and the gas exploded, and so the landlord's wife was killed. And so there they still found that the issue of duty wasn't an issue there, because no one talked about whether he owed a duty to the landlord. And that was one of the cases on which Back 2 relies. And so it's a new clarification. It's putting in a civil definition of negligence and duty and special relationship that simply didn't exist beforehand. It's similar to in State versus Hayward, where there's a new view of whether or not a BB gun counted as a gun for purposes of the firearm.
I mean, that's a little different. The law, I mean, the issue there was what is a gun, and and at least the Court of Appeals had always determined that a BB gun was a gun within the meaning of the statute. So there was a distinct change in the law, but you know, coming from from my work as a private attorney, I mean, duty has always been a concept. And it's always been a key concept in the in applying the any negligence action. And a negligent homicide necessarily uses those concepts. So this wasn't anything new. There may to look at whether there was a duty or not.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I think it put in a new duty. If you also look at State versus Frost, which was a 1983 decision, which was also mentioned in the second Back decision, it talks about a woman who shoots her husband when he grabs the gun. And there's no discussion in the case about a duty. That had never been something that had been, I'm not saying that a duty didn't exist, to be clear. A duty has always existed, but the emphasis on it and the clarification of what role that played changed in the second Back decision. Therefore, it's the state's position that under Kingbird, this court should reverse the district court. But even if this court—
Ms. Lawan, okay, one more. Before we let go of that issue, I'm looking at the 2009 Back opinion. The Supreme Court referred to Pitola, a 1985 case, and it said that it referenced Pitola for establishing the premise that there is always a threshold issue about duty before you get to the foreseeability issue. Isn't the law that's stated in Back in 2009 basically the same law that applied in Pitola in 1985?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I think that it clarified it and it changed it. And so based on that clarification, Kingbird would control. But even if you just
change, I mean, can you be specific about what is the change in the law then?
It's importing a special duty of a special relationship. It's a duty to protect and a duty to, a duty to protect and also a duty to defend. It's different in that it's adding in more of a civil concept to it. And I think that in reading back to, that was not at issue for the parties at all. It was not addressed by the parties. It was not briefed by the parties. I believe there's a footnote that discusses that, that shows that it was not something where everyone thought that this was going to be the threshold issue. It was an issue of proximate. It was an issue of her awareness at the time and whether she had created this risk. But even if you disagree with me, Your Honor, it still does not amount to in a definition of exoneration being met in this case because Ms. Back does not have clean hands. So even if Kingbird is out of the question, which my best argument I thought was Kingbird, but if this court does not believe that Kingbird applies, she still does not have clean hands. If you look at the circumstances of this case.
I want to talk about that because, it seems like there's two things going on in the statute. One is she eligible to even make a claim? And that's where we get into the issue of whether there are grounds consistent with innocence.
Correct.
And the legislature did define that, but let's even assuming we determine that it is on grounds consistent with innocence. How do you interpret subdivision 4, where you bring in all this evidence and you look at the issue of whether her acts contributed to the crime, and contributed to the offenses that may have been committed. And you allow the victims to come in and give evidence. How do you view that requirement regarding evidence in light of the fact that there may be a determination that she is eligible to bring a claim? Wouldn't that just end if that were all there was? And so I don't know what is the purpose of the subdivision for?
The purpose of the subdivisions is to read them in conjunction together. Subdivision 3 talks about whether or not someone can qualify as exonerated, but subdivision 4 outlines what evidence the court can consider and in fact, what evidence the parties can present. And it's very open, you're right, Your Honor, that they can present evidence from the victims as far as their input. They can also put in evidence that might not have been allowed in a post-conviction proceeding because they can put in evidence that might not be newly discovered. It could be known to them. It could be something that existed at the time of trial. That's what the any evidence discusses. Because of that, that impacts whether or not someone should qualify. In essence, the language allows for a clean hands determination. It just doesn't articulate it as
Ms. Lawan, I want to follow up on that. Number one, you agree there's no reference to clean hands in the statute. So you're asking us to, and there's no case law, at least I didn't see any that you cited that would suggest, and this is a fairly new statute, even as modified, even the old statute is fairly new, but you're asking us to basically create a clean hands equitable defense to the statutory cause of action for which there's no language in the statute that provides for such a defense.
I agree that there is no, the words clean hands do not appear. Absolutely, Your Honor. But if you look at the statute, the court is allowed to consider, subdivision 4 talks about how they can consider acts by the petitioner that may have contributed to bringing about the conviction. And, well, and
let me just ask you that. Okay, because Judge Hooten had asked too, what is the conviction for which acts were brought about?
Well, if you, the rest of the sentence says any other offenses that may have been committed by the petitioner in the same behavioral incident. So
did
I think
the state,
it's
during the evidentiary, I noticed the state didn't present a transcript, so I'm assuming the state's not asking us to review it for clearly erroneous findings. But in any event, by the court's findings, I didn't see that the state, in response to the petitioner's request, presented any evidence of another crime under the same behavioral incident. Am I correct about that?
This brings about the problem, Your Honor, with reading the statute the way that Ms. Back and the district court did. It prevents, it basically would require the prosecutor to charge any and every crime that could possibly have taken place at the time.
Why?
Because of the fact that if an individual is convicted of something and later that conviction is vacated, if there are no other underlying felonies and you can't look at what else happened and you can't look at any other crimes, then that individual would qualify as exonerated.
Did the state ask the court to look at any other crimes? That's what I'm getting at. Was the judge presented by the state with evidence of any other crime besides the one the Supreme Court said could not have existed here that did occur and that she committed it?
I understand. No, I apologize, Your Honor. I think I misunderstood you earlier. Oh, okay. The state did not present any other evidence, and I don't have any issue with the district court's factual findings. In fact, this is an order that it shows the tortured nature of this statute, because Judge Meyer is noting specifically there would not be a murder but for Dana Back's actions. None of this would have happened had she not brought the parties together. And because of that, she doesn't have clean hands. And
would you agree, though, that obviously the respondent has a different opinion, thinks the statute is fairly clear on its face, we should just read it, and you're telling us it's tortured. An interesting dichotomy we have in the two arguments. But wouldn't you agree that the Supreme Court described the conduct for which she was convicted not to be a crime? And if the state presents no other crime, what other scenario could the exoneration statute ever apply?
It's not just whether there's another crime. It's also anything that the petitioner did to bring about the conviction. So to bring about the murder, it can't just be looked at in whether or not
conviction. Wouldn't it have to be a conviction she brought about?
My reading of the statute is that it's, you look at the entirety of the same behavioral incident, not just what she was charged with. You look at everything that took place and what that conviction that arose from that, which was vacated, but you look at what happened, everything. And subdivision 4 talks about acts by the petitioner that may have contributed to bringing about the conviction. So here, her conviction for culpable negligence and any other offenses that may have been committed by the petitioner in the same behavioral incident. Here, she threw a bottle at someone.
But you've shared, though, with me now that you didn't present any other acts to the judge for the judge to make such a finding. And I agree with you in terms of that interpretation appears to allow for, even if a crime was never charged, but the state under the civil standard essentially here in this could have presented some crime.
I agree the state could have. I'm sorry.
Then I understand your point being is she may not have qualified, notwithstanding the offense for which she was convicted, but you're telling me there was no evidence of another crime. There, she wasn't convicted of this. And so reading that sentence, then the only thing that we're left with, and that's the clean hand you're talking about, is her role was bad, right? Her role was bad in this, but you're asking us therefore to impute then that as some form of a clean hands, unclean hands.
Her role was involved. She's not blameless in this. And that's the problem, is that she was not just a bystander. She was not someone who was not.
What I'm trying to ask you, though, is what does it matter whether she was involved if her acts didn't either lead to a conviction or she did not commit another crime by the reading of the statute?
It matters, Your Honor, because we don't look at it in isolation as to what was presented at the evidentiary hearing here. There's also the trial transcript and the transcript of what happened and what took place over the course of it. Yes, that conviction has been vacated, but this court can look at the entire record of what happened and what transpired, including what Ms. Back testified to having taken place. And the district court flat out rejected that and said that she was not credible and she was trying to cover her tracks in a sense and try to make herself appear better. And so even though the state did not bring additional evidence of other charges at this point, I don't think that prohibits a finding that she does not qualify as exonerated, because you cannot ignore the context of what took place here. This is not a situation where it's a wrongful conviction. This is not a situation where there is DNA that exonerates someone. This is a legal technicality, which it is the state's position was new at the point that Dana Back was decided in 2002.
Does it necessarily have to be new, though, in order for this statute to apply?
In order for Kingbird to apply, or because, in order?
Because, in other words, I mean, under your definition, she wouldn't even be eligible to even bring a claim. Am I correct? Under your arguments here.
She would not qualify as exonerated to bring a claim for compensation. Right. Correct.
All right. But let's just, and again, assuming that she is exonerated, because subdivision 4 assumes you're exonerated.
I mean, but
nonetheless, lets in all this evidence, which you think means that she has to show she has clean hands here.
I don't think that subdivision 4 assumes that you're exonerated. I think that's
where it actually starts out. Court records related to the conviction and the exoneration are admissible in the proceeding under this section.
I don't read that to mean that it limits.
I don't think you get to subdivision 4 unless you've been exonerated.
I don't think that you can read what can or cannot be considered at a hearing to determine exoneration in isolation. I think that you can't get to subdivision 3 without considering subdivision 4. If you can't consider what other evidence the prosecutor could put on to determine whether or not someone is exonerated, it doesn't make sense in my view of in reading the statute to just assume someone's exonerated and then say, but now the state can put on evidence to show that. I don't think that subdivision 4 only pertains to the amount of eligibility of money. It pertains to whether or not she is exonerated.
We haven't yet talked about subdivision 5, and if I may, Judge Schlatter, go a little bit over our time.
Yes, you may.
But that seems to me that subdivision 5 contains, the caption is elements, sort of the requirements of proof for a petitioner ultimately to prevail. And it seems like it requires first that the person is eligible for compensation under subdivision 3, and then proof of 4 enumerated items. Am I correct in that so far?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then so where, I mean, which of those 4 items or which of those items is the unclean hands relevant to? I mean, how would you use evidence of unclean hands to defeat one of the elements of proof?
This is where I think subdivision 4 pertains to determining subdivision 3. Because then that goes into subdivision 5 paren A. And I apologize, I should ask if I could answer the question. I see I'm over my time, but a claim arises if the person is eligible under subdivision 3. But subdivision 3 can only be achieved after considering the evidence in subdivision 4.
Or
so
perhaps the evidence in subdivision 4 informs the decisions on the substantive criteria in subdivision 5.
It could as well, especially paren 2, if someone was convicted of multiple charges. Here we don't have that because there was only the one charge that remained, but it discusses the same behavioral incident. To me, that means you look at all of the conduct. You can't just look at this in isolation.
My comments about subdivision 5, is that a matter of case law? Have any of the previous precedential cases spoken to that issue, the sort of the centrality of subdivision 5?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Okay. It's a limited area of case law. It seems that this is the main case that goes up and down, but other than that, there has not been much that I've seen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I ask a further question?
Yes, you may, Judge Hooten, and you may answer, Ms. Lewan.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any, I mean, what can you point to that would support what the judge did in this case, which was basically, I think I could, if I had to explain it, it would be splitting the baby and saying, oh, well, I think there's unclean hands here. I think you were exonerated. I think you're eligible, but I've heard all this evidence and these people, you know, are really against this. The prosecutor's really against this because they think your acts contributed to the crime or to what was charged anyway, to the conviction, and that and that you don't, and Ms. Beck does not have clean hands. Is there anything in the statute that would support what the judge did in saying, well, I'm only going to allow part of your claim to proceed?
I think the answer, Your Honor, is that there isn't anything that prohibited it. That's the problem with this statute. It doesn't make it clear, as the judge said, what role you can or cannot place if subdivision 4 knocks it out completely, or if it just eliminates the amount or limits the amount of money. And I think that the district court correctly recognized that, and that points to why there needs to be clarification from this court, or requesting for the legislature to clarify it.
If the judge found that she had unclean hands, I mean, does the statute, could it also be interpreted to allow no recovery?
Yes, and that's the state's position, that based on the unclean hands, she should not be allowed to recover anything, but at a minimum, her recovery should be limited. So I would ask that the district court be reversed in finding that Ms. Beck qualifies as exonerated. But if the court does not reverse that, we would ask that the court affirm the district court's finding that her recovery is limited based on her conduct and the fact that she facilitated and was in the middle of this.
If I may clarify, I think it's your primary argument that the district court concluded that petitioner is eligible to file a claim under the statute. And I think your primary argument is that because of the unclean hands, et cetera, she's not eligible.
Yes.
She's not exonerated, therefore she's not eligible to go forward.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And
go ahead, Judge.
Another question. But how do you explain the first sentence of subdivision 4, which assumes that there's been an exoneration?
Because one reads a statute in its entirety. And I don't think that you can isolate subdivision 4 and treat it as a silo. I think that would.
But if she hasn't been exonerated, then you don't even get to 4, do you? But
I don't think you can get to whether she's exonerated without considering the evidence. And the evidence is described in subdivision 4 as to what can be considered. So I think you have to have both, despite that first sentence that I wish wasn't there. You have to have both.
I mean, because I just don't know how, how can you admit the exoneration?
I agree.
Not find that she's eligible as an exonerated person.
I'm not saying that she's exonerated. She's not exonerated. She has a conviction that's been vacated. It's the fact that she cannot establish that it was on the grounds consistent with innocence, which is a burden of persuasion on the defendant here, and she cannot meet that. And the reason she cannot meet that is the evidence that's allowed here does not permit it, because she doesn't have clean hands. And the evidence that we consider is outlined in subdivision 4. So I think it's inartfully worded, but subdivision 4 matters.
I'm going to use some discretion to ask a follow-up question then, Ms. Luan, and that is, towards the end there, you just said that she didn't meet the definition of exonerated. And I got a two-part question before I get, but the first part, I just wanted you to point me to then, are you referring to the grounds consistent with innocence definition that the new statute provides in subdivision 1C2?
Yes, Your Honor.
And which part of that do you believe she does not qualify for exoneration?
Any evidence of factual innocence. She has not established factual innocence. And if the statute is read completely, it says any evidence of factual evidence, whether it was available at the time of investigation or trial or newly discovered.
And
so that's what we're talking about.
And I'll tie it into your point about unclean hands. Factual innocence to what?
Factual innocence to the crime for which she was convicted and that was vacated. And here that I would point
so
to.
So let me just clarify then. How do we square then what you just said with the Supreme Court's determination that her conduct did not meet the crime? How could she not be factually innocent, given our court's interpretation, both in Kingburn and Freeman, that means any evidence would suggest other than guilt by the plain language of that?
For a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First, because I think I believe Kingburn applies here, because back to was a new interpretation of culpable negligence.
Okay, but separate from, yeah, I understand.
Separate from that. Also, I just didn't want to let that one go. Second from that, we also have the fact that if you look at Judge Holbrook's dissent, I believe in the 2016 decision, she talks about the habeas standard of actual innocence, which is also the standard that applies in post-conviction cases for when someone is proving actual innocence, and how it's not just a finding of not guilty equating to innocence. It's not just a finding of a legal technicality amounting to blamelessness. And there's a quote that she has, and I believe I have it on page 26 of my brief, I believe I quote it. And I recognize this is a dissent. This is just the language that I would point to, where she talks about how actual innocence means factual innocence, not mere legal insufficiency. So the fact that someone's conduct cannot necessarily equate to a conviction of a crime does not mean that they are blameless. It does not mean that they are factually innocent. It does not mean that they are actually innocent. Here she is not blameless.
Just to follow up then, unclean hands, as I understand it, is an equitable affirmative defense. Am I correct in that regard?
I would agree with that. Perhaps we could say that we're arguing it as a defense to it. I mean, I think we could show that she doesn't have unclean hands based on what is the testimony and the trial record, which is part of the record here.
Well, just to say it broadly, my understanding generally in equity is that one may have a claim and a cause of action and maybe a successful one, but because of their unclean hands in a court of equity, we will not provide a remedy. Now, that would imply here, does it not, that she qualifies, she's exonerated, she meets the definition, but because her hands are unclean, you will not receive compensation.
That could be one way to interpret the statute if subdivision 4 was then read to apply, as Judge Hooten has said, with regard to a finding that she's exonerated, but then it knocks it out. But then the problem is, what is considered for factual innocence? And so that's
how are
the
you
problem.
Applying it? Well, so go ahead, Judge Hooten.
And I know you mentioned Judge Holbrook's discussion of the habeas situation and actual innocence, but that's when there's a legal technicality. And it's for example, a drug dealer who basically there's an unconstitutional search. And in that case, that drug dealer may get off of the charge because of the unconstitutional search, but can't establish any evidence of factual innocence. Now, I think that's the easy case, but this case, and I think you've got to focus, this is a different standard than Judge Holbrook's was talking about.
I agree, Your Honor.
The new standard is any evidence of factual innocence.
But with the any evidence of factual innocence, Your Honor, it's discussing if it's new, if it existed at the time. That's my reading of that, is that it has to do with not prohibiting something that might have happened if this were a NAFLA bar, say if we were in post-conviction world. But if this court were to look at its decision in Freeman versus State, which was decided in 2020, there's a discussion about how DNA evidence or an alibi witness to show someone else committed an offense, how that would amount to factual innocence. That's not a legal technicality. It's someone not even being present. It's a wrongful conviction. It's not just you don't quite meet the standard, but you did something that was criminal.
And the problematic thing in this case is our Supreme Court has said her behavior, maybe it's reprehensible, but it's not a crime.
Correct, Your Honor. But the
so if that's not evidence of factual innocence, I'm not sure. I mean, because it's factual innocence of a crime.
Correct, Your Honor, but factual innocence is not the same standard as legal innocence. If the legislature wanted to say the mere vacation of a conviction equals exoneration, they could have. Here they said vacation and factual innocence. It's in essence vacation of conviction plus you didn't do it, plus you weren't there, plus DNA shows somebody else did it, plus you didn't happen to have someone drive you to a scene and then kill someone while you're in the middle of it. This is not the case. This is a difficult case. This is a unique case based on those circumstances. But here, I do not think she qualifies. And even if she did qualify as exonerated, her unclean hands knock out any chance of an award. Either way, she should not be compensated for what she facilitated and for the death that took place here.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Lawan, and you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, if you feel that you need additional time since we allowed Ms. Lawan, mostly because of our questions, you can let us know, but you may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'm Joseph Ganji. I represent the respondent in this matter, Dana Back. She is present with me, seated a safe 6 feet over to my side here. I'd like to start my comments today by just briefly going over the purpose of this statute, and then I'll get into briefly my cross appeal, and then I'll address the state's appeal with particular reference to subdivision one and the Kingbird case. So the purpose of this statute is to compensate those people who went to prison for a crime they did not commit. The idea behind this is that the person never should have been in prison. And so we are going to compensate that person for the damages that they have suffered by the simple fact that they were in prison and shouldn't have been. Compensating for loss of time, loss of freedom, etc. And that is a policy choice that the legislature has made.
Let's talk about that policy choice, because if that was the sole policy of this statute, why in the world didn't they just stop with eligibility? You're eligible, you're exonerated, done. Why did they ever add subdivision four and all the, you know, allow the prosecutor, notwithstanding the exoneration, to object and allow all these witnesses to come in and say how horrible this person is? Why would you need that? I mean, the way that you're approaching this, we should be done. As soon as you figure out they're eligible, done. Just figure out what their damages are. So obviously, if you're talking about policy, the legislature went to a lot of effort to do subdivision four. And it's got to mean something.
I agree, Your Honor. It does mean something. So that goes right into how this statute is framed. And it's important because subdivision one, which has been already decided by a few different appellate courts, is just a threshold issue. It's simply, are you exonerated or not? And exoneration is not a place where we're going to weigh evidence. It's not a place where the prosecutor comes in and produces contrary evidence. It's simply a burden of production on the petitioner to provide any evidence of factual innocence. If you can do that, you're in the door. Now,
I know you're still answering my question, but as long as you're talking about this, what about the argument of the appellant that this is not a case of any evidence of factual innocence, that this is not consistent with that new definition?
Well, that goes down a whole different road, Your Honor. I think this is evidence of factual innocence. I think the whole case is evidence of factual innocence because, as the Supreme Court in her direct appeal stated, she did not commit a crime. When her conduct is not criminal, it doesn't get any more factually innocent than that. You simply didn't commit a crime. So once you get over that hurdle in exoneration, then you move on to the next phase, which is your hearing. And that your hearing is an evidentiary hearing under subdivision three and four. These two subdivisions need to be read together. Subdivision three is the standard. The standard is proof by a preponderance of the evidence that the crime wasn't committed. And that's your innocent standard. So you can meet your burden of production in subdivision one, but that doesn't mean that you've necessarily met your burden of actually proving your factual innocence by preponderance of the evidence, because there could be other things out there. That's why subdivision four exists. It colors the district court's hearing and it allows evidence in, and the court can consider all of this evidence when deciding eligibility. In other words, did the petitioner meet the burden by preponderance of the evidence? That's where subdivision four comes in.
And so, Mr. Ganji, then taking into account subdivision three and four, as you've described, what different perhaps about what occurred at the hearing, and I'm really focusing on the state, and I asked Ms. Lawan about that, sort of evidence do you believe the state could have, or let's say, or if they had, would have led to a decision by the court that she's not exonerated, notwithstanding the Supreme Court's decision on the manslaughter, specific manslaughter offense. What's the hypothetical that you think would have fit the statute that would have properly then resulted in a non-exoneration ruling, notwithstanding getting in the door, as you describe?
I personally do not believe that the state could have presented anything that would have prevented the district court from ruling the way it did. And I actually moved for a summary disposition in this case because the facts are undisputed and there's only one way to determine that, which is you did not commit the crime. You have proven your innocence by preponderance of the evidence.
Would you agree, though, by your reading, let's assume, and I understand that point, and that's why I'm somewhat hypothetical. I'm trying to understand how the statute works with the way you're structuring it. In any situation, what evidence would have needed to be presented to the judge in order to find no exoneration despite meeting the first definition, subdivision one?
Well, again, I can't really do that in this case because the conduct wasn't criminal. So if for example, the state presented evidence of a duty, I suppose, that might give rise to maybe you weren't factually innocent of this, but has already been decided. So I think subdivision four is really geared towards that other case where maybe the facts are not quite so clear, where there could be other things involved as far as whether the person is factually innocent or not.
Would you agree, though, for instance, go ahead, Judge Hooten.
No, you go ahead. You started first.
Well, just to follow up with that, let's assume, though not charged, the state had presented evidence she provided the gun to the shooter and therefore could have been and arguably guilty then of aiding and abetting given that participation in the ultimate crime, but was never charged. Would you agree that sort of evidence would make her unexonerated, essentially, if the judge believed it? Because that would be a crime that she committed, was never charged with, but it was a crime arising out of the same incident, nevertheless, or her conduct would have been a crime arising from those same facts.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think in subdivision three, it talks about the crime that sent Miss back to prison. And going back to the purpose of the statute, the idea is if you did not commit the crime that you went to prison for and you never should have been in prison, then we're going to compensate you as a policy choice. And I don't see that as really fitting in here.
How does that square, though, with subdivision four, the sentence I think Judge Hooten asked Ms. Lawan about any other offense that may have been committed by the petitioner in the same behavioral incident?
So those different acts may lead a court to believe that the petitioner did in fact commit the crime for which they went to prison. So the judge can consider these other acts that the petitioner may have done, but these acts don't disqualify the person from being eligible for compensation. These acts color the district court's analysis of whether, you know, of this ultimate issue, which is, did you prove by a preponderance of the evidence that you're factually innocent of the crime that put you in prison? Like the statements from the victims, you know, what purpose does that have? It didn't have much in this case, but maybe in a different case, there's some evidence there that the victims have that color that analysis.
Well, can I ask you, because if the statute were worded the way you suggest that if you could show by preponderance of the evidence that they were guilty of something, maybe a tort, that would make our job so much easier. But that's the statute actually says both the petitioner and the prosecutor have a right to present additional evidence. The court may consider acts by the petitioner that may have contributed to bringing about the conviction and any other offenses that may have been committed by the petitioner in the same behavioral incident. So that seems to say that the court, you may look at those acts, you don't have to prove that they committed another crime necessarily. It's just whether it contributed to the conviction that ultimately came about with their acts. And I guess I go back to the case that all that that actually the legislature was based these whole statutes on is the Toyota case, where the guy in that case was convicted of vehicular homicide, but as it turns out, there was a defect in the Toyota, and a determination that he actually, there was no indication that anything he did contributed to what occurred there. Isn't this case different? Because even though she was convicted and her conduct wasn't a crime, her conduct nonetheless may have contributed to the conviction that, that took place. Because I mean, is that another way to interpret this statute?
Well, two things on that, Judge. First, just very briefly on the Toyota case, the person who was convicted there was later found to be negligent in a civil case. So it's not like he didn't do anything wrong in that. I just want to point that out. But second, when you read subdivision 4, it says the court may consider acts. And the question then is, why is the court considering these? What is the point of consideration of these other acts? That has to tie back to the ultimate ruling that the judge is going to make, which is the subdivision 3 ruling. Did you prove by a preponderance of the evidence that you didn't commit the crime? And the court can consider these things in making that ruling, but it doesn't give rise to a court in its discretion to say, yeah, you're innocent, but we're gonna limit the amount because of these other acts in subdivision 4. This is just the evidence that goes into that ultimate ruling, which is subdivision 3. That kind of leads to my cross appeal, actually, because the court—
Well, and again, I understand, I mean, it's a great argument that you're making, but I don't see it in the statute. And I guess, because it would have been so easy for the legislature to say, you must prove a conviction by the preponderance of the evidence, or if you prove the conviction by preponderance of the evidence, then you may proceed to claim to damages.
And I believe it does say that, Your Honor. I believe subdivision 3B clearly says that. And then when you get to subdivision 4, it says court records relating to the conviction are admissible under a proceeding in this section. So it contemplates that proceeding in which there's evidence presented to make that determination in subdivision 3.
And what would the purpose then, I mean, if that's the purpose and the policy, why would you allow the victims to testify as to whether they give their opinion as to whether it should be granted or not granted?
Right. And I can think that in maybe some circumstances, the victims have information to give to the court that lends a weight as far as what the court decides for innocent. And this could be when there's a close case on the issue. We don't have a close case here because the conduct wasn't criminal. I also think that when you look at subdivision 4, and in fact, when you look at the entire section, section 590.11, this is an eligibility statute only. It doesn't deal with the amount of compensation. The amount is a completely different proceeding. You file a separate petition once you get this order of eligibility to a Supreme Court panel. There are three panel members. They decide the amount, and the legislature has decided you're entitled to these types of damages. And by the way, we're going to have a minimum amount of compensation that you're entitled to. That is a policy choice the legislature already made.
Do you think the judge erred then in basically splitting the baby the way the judge did?
Absolutely. I believe the judge used the criterion subdivision 4 and kind of weighed it with its own sense of whether Ms. Beck is deserving of a certain amount of compensation to limit the possible amount that she can claim. That is contrary, in my mind, to the way the statute is written, but also in the legislative policy choice that has already been made as far as what we're going to do for these particular people who should not have been in prison. The legislature has chosen what to compensate and how much, or at least and at least set a minimum amount for them. And that's the whole idea behind this. If you are innocent and you never should have been in prison, as a state, we have decided that we're going to do this for those people.
DeAngelo, can you point me to the limiting language in the order? Because I mean, the conclusion of the order says she's eligible. In the final paragraph under the heading order basically just says she's eligible. I don't see any limitation necessarily. Where do you find that? I understand there's a lot of discussion of the unclean hands, you know, and et cetera, which could factor in the future. But I don't see any bright lines or anything that's specific that forecloses her claim, even in part, going forward.
Right, and the part I'm referring to is on page, I believe it's 10, no, it's page 9, where the court makes a specific finding that if subdivision 4 is meant to do kind of a balancing test, that Ms. Back would only be entitled to a certain minimum amount of compensation. It's kind of a nuanced finding. It's kind of a conditional finding, and it leaves things way up in the air for compensation panel to maybe look at this and say, well, there's a specific finding here. And so that's why I'm bringing that appeal forward, is because there is a finding. It may be conditional, but it nevertheless is a finding that I think should be stricken.
So I read that conditional is one way to describe it. I was thinking that it was maybe reasoning in the alternative, because it seems like the district judge previously determined that she was exonerated, she is eligible. But this is, the key word is if a different legal analysis is required or permitted, then she would have a different conclusion. But it seems like then in the end, she came back to her decision that petitioner is eligible. Are you and I saying different things?
I think we're saying the same thing, Judge.
I guess, so let's assume for the moment that if we were to reject the state's argument for reversal in the primary appeal, do you necessarily need relief on your cross appeal, or if we were to resolve the state's appeal by saying she is eligible, period, do you need relief in your cross appeal, or do you have everything you need going forward with that ruling?
It's the reason I brought this is because of the what ifs, and the way it's phrased to me, I would interpret this the same way, Judge, where it's kind of that alternative conditional finding. It doesn't really control, but I'm worried that someone else may look at this wording here and believe that it does control, because they are going to make a determination that there is a balancing test. And so therefore this finding does control. So I'm not sure that answers your question, but.
Appreciate it.
I see I'm out of time.
Judge, another question? Yes.
Question? And I think you should get some extra time too.
That's right.
Because to be fair, I'm gonna ask a question.
It's a privilege, not a burden, right? To be asked additional questions.
But one of the findings of the judge is that she played a significant part in the crime that was committed. And is that finding, are you claiming that finding is clearly erroneous?
I'm not claiming that any findings are clearly erroneous in this case. The ultimate determination is that she's eligible because she did not commit the crime. And that's really all that's important in 590.11. Are you innocent? Yes or no? Are you eligible? Yes or no?
So you're not disputing that finding a fact. You're just saying as a matter of law, she was exonerated, and that notwithstanding this finding, she should still recover as a matter of law. Is that?
I do dispute those facts, but I haven't raised those in this appeal.
And I didn't think you had. So right. I think we have to assume that fact is paramount here. It's not on appeal that she did play a significant part in the crime that was committed. So the issue is whether that finding is sufficient under subdivision 4 to basically block or to support a judge's decision to not proceed any further.
And the thing is, Your Honor, playing a part in something that happened would not have sent Ms. back to prison. So that's kind of the key purpose behind this. She should not have been in prison, and because she's actually innocent of the crime that sent her to prison. And so she suffered these very unique damages as a fact of going to prison, which again is kind of that legislative choice. It's not a policy or it's not a weighing of clean hands versus this kind of thing with subdivision 1 or 3 or 4, because the key word here is innocence, and innocence is defined by the legislature. It's not defined by someone's sense of moral right or wrong. It's defined by what is actually criminal as defined by the legislature. And if a person's conduct was not criminal as defined by the legislature, they never should have gone to prison. And that's why Ms. Backer is eligible for compensation, and the district court was correct in making that determination.
If there are any
questions, I'm well past my time, and I thank the court.
If you had a final statement, since we do still probably owe you a little bit of time yet, and you have a privilege to provide it, you may do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the district court did get this case correct in finding that Ms. Back is eligible for compensation. The whole scheme work of this statute is designed to provide compensation to people who are eligible. The 590.11 sets out a scheme for a district court to determine eligibility based on judicial standards. That's why we have subdivision 3 standard and a subdivision 4 evidentiary standard. The court here went through all of that. I don't believe it needed to necessarily, but that's the way the statute works. Here, Ms. Back's conduct was not criminal, and therefore she is factually innocent, and it was correct for the district court to grant her petition and find her eligible for compensation. She should be allowed to go to that next stage, which is the compensation panel, where the amount of compensation is determined. That's not something the district court should be looking at or viewing, because that's not the role of the district court as set out in the statute. The district court's role is simply eligibility, and that's subdivision 3. Have you proven what you needed to prove by a preponderance of the evidence? Here, the answer is yes. And the district court should be affirmed in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ganji. And Ms. Lamont, we'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. But I do have one quick question for you then. If I understand, getting back to the clean hands, and my understanding of that defense or affirmative defense in an equitable cause of action, do I understand you to say that by these facts, the bad thing she's alleged to have done during this incident, if they had not present. So for instance, if she presented evidence that the court found credible that the perpetrator forced her to come with him, that she told him not to come with him, but she was there but would have been exonerated. Your point being is that would be relevant evidence for the court. That's the sort of clean hands, in other words, you think the statute requires before one can be eligible.
Yes, Your Honor. And if I understand your question correctly, any evidence, if she were to say that someone forced her to provide a gun or to drive, and she didn't provide a gun, I'm not trying to say that, someone forced her to set this up, or that she didn't do this of her own volition, or if she were to provide evidence that she wasn't there, someone else was there, that of course would be relevant. And that's why it's discussed in subdivision 4. I agree with counsel that it has to, that subdivision 4 has an interplay with subdivision 3. If it wasn't admissible, it wouldn't be relevant. It's relevant here, because if only her eligibility is what this statute determines, then why are we talking about what her conduct was during that incident? Because it matters. It matters as to whether or not she is eligible to qualify as exonerated. And it's the petitioner's burden. It's not the state's burden to show that some other crime could have been committed. The trial record is completely part of this record here. The state doesn't have to.
But just to clarify that, the state has that opportunity. That's why I asked early on. Absolutely. In other words, we probably wouldn't be here if you had presented evidence by a preponderance.
I think we'd still be here.
Well, okay, and perhaps a different. But my question then, subdivision three, and I'm still trying to hone in on how you are reading it. So subdivision 3B, the court shall determine if an individual who is exonerated, so we're presuming she's exonerated, is eligible for compensation based on establishment of innocence if the petitioner establishes that a crime was not committed or that the crime was not committed. So it seems pretty clearly on its face, one way or another, a crime has to be shown either not to have been committed. Am I correct?
It's clear that they have to show, I think the district court did say here that she didn't pull the trigger. She did that there was a homicide and she did not commit the homicide, but it's whether or not she committed a crime. And if she cannot have been committing the crime due to a legal technicality, that's where the other actions come into play from subdivision.
Well, you use the phrase legal technicality. I suppose we might quibble about this, but the point is the crime that she was convicted of, the court said was not a crime. So that's more than a technicality, I suspect. What I'm trying to get at is then, did the court make a finding that she committed a crime?
No, I don't believe the court did. And I do still believe that Kingbird controls here, because here they were interpreting, adding in a civil duty aspect into a criminal culpable negligence standard. I'm not saying that duty wasn't an issue, but the discussion of it and the degree to which it came into play was new following back to. And I would point out too that vacating a conviction does not automatically amount to innocence here. That's why the statute doesn't just say your conviction was vacated. It says, and there was evidence of factual of vacated on grounds consistent with innocence. And grounds consistent with innocence involves factual innocence. Factual innocence is a higher standard here than just the evidence was insufficient due to an element being missing. It's not just a matter of checking off elements and then seeing whether or not someone is convicted of a crime. The underlying actions take a part, and the underlying conduct of the defendant and whether her conduct played in that part. And here the district court undisputedly found that she played a significant part in this, in something that happened, and that happened because of her. There would not be a murder but for her.
But are you claiming, if there's been an exoneration, then you're claiming that they can proceed. So you're tying everything back to the definition of whether they've been exonerated.
I think it all comes down to what factual innocence means. And that's ambiguous here. And that is, if she is factually innocent, then she can qualify as exonerated. But if she is not factually innocent, she can't. And it also comes down to the interplay of subdivision 4. If we
just
aren't
to clarify again, Ms. Lewine, on this is maybe where respondent's brief. It's the of what? In other words, factually innocence of being a good or bad person versus factual innocence of a crime.
And I'm not which saying those, it's. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Which of those? I just wanted to be sure.
It's not whether she's a good or bad person. It's whether what she did played a part in a crime being committed. And in the fact that she may have had that conviction vacated because she did not owe a duty. However, her actions led to a crime being committed by someone else. There is no question here that a crime took place. Whether she did it or not is not the ultimate question. Her involvement plays a role in whether or not she should be compensated for what took place and what happened. I'm not saying that she should go back to prison. That's not what we're saying. She simply should not make a windfall from this when someone was killed basically as a result of her actions, but for her actions, which respondent is not disputing, but for her actions, there would be no murder. This is not a case where someone is wrongfully convicted and spent years in prison for a rape or a homicide that they weren't a party to, that they weren't committing. I see that my time has expired. I would respectfully ask that the district court be reversed. Unless there are further questions, my apologies.
May I ask one more question? I promise just one.
Indeed, you may.
Ms. Lewine, I guess for purposes of my figuring out the role of the cross appeal here, what is the state's position? I mean, if we were to reject your arguments for reversal, so what we have is the court order saying that petitioner is eligible, what's the state's position about, is she limited in some way going forward I mean, is there a qualification on her eligibility that might limit her at the next step of the proceedings?
Yes, Your Honor, there would be a qualification limiting it. The district court made that explicit finding. It is on page 9 at the bottom, saying I'm making a specific finding that if the court's meant to balance the acts and the other considerations, she would not be entitled to compensation for any period before the conviction was reversed. I recognize that this is a statute dealing with eligibility, but her role takes a place, has an impact on how much she's compensated as well.
So then under your view, we would be required to resolve the cross appeal. We would be required to answer that if then whether the court is intended to balance her acts and other considerations in subdivision 4 for purposes of determining eligibility.
Yes, Your Honor, I would believe that the court would. I would also, even if the court were to feel that it does not need to do so, I would ask that the court do so since the question is here, and any guidance on this statute would be appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very well. Thank you both to both counsel. Judge Hooten, did you have?
I just have one question.
Sure.
In that there's an undisputed fact that she played a significant role in the crime that was committed.
Mm-hmm.
Is she eligible under your theory for any compensation at all? Is there any?
No.
I mean, as a matter of law, would that in the inquiry here as to whether she proceeded?
Yes, Your Honor, that would end it. Her involvement means she's not entitled to anything.
Okay. And so you think the court erred in basically saying you only get half of what you're claiming here because of the.
I think
the judge based it on the back decision coming out.
Yes. So I would say that we would say she's not entitled to any compensation because she doesn't qualify as exonerated. If she does qualify as exonerated, it should be limited based on her involvement. So either nothing or limited, if that answers the question.
Okay. But there's nothing in the statute itself that you can point to that would support the limitation.
I think that's where subdivision 4, not a case that I'm aware of, but I think that's where subdivision 4 comes in again, the evidence. And if they weren't to consider that as to whether she's eligible, I don't know why it would be included there. We can't just render it meaningless.
But wouldn't that be pertinent to damages though? I mean, and that's a whole different proceeding, isn't it?
It is, but it's also what I'm referring to as the clean hands provision, Your Honor, but the discussion about what she may have done to contribute and what happened in that incident is here when you even get to the eligibility. I don't see anything limiting the court from limiting the award.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you both to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our many questions that we had, and we appreciate it. Hope you do consider it a privilege as well, because we do.